Hello and welcome. My guest today set off a storm of controversy as one of the authors of a study published in the British medical journal The Lancet in February 1998. The study's participants were 12 children suffering from various ailments which several of their parents felt were triggered by the MMR vaccine. While the study pointed no finger at the vaccine, it did recommend further research should be done. 15 years later, one of the authors, Dr. Andrew Wakefield, felt the full wrath of the pharmaceutical industrial complex. The paper was retracted from The Lancet, his medical license revoked, and his reputation given a severe blow, at least in the eyes of those responsible for his professional assassination, and, of course, members of the public still trusting in the mainstream media's modus operandi. Dr. Wakefield is not taking any of this sitting down. He's penned a new book defending the study's methods and results and bringing answers to his detractors' charges to the court of public opinion. He clearly shows how the fix was in. The British medical authorities, many with close financial ties to the pharmaceutical industry, were not interested in the facts. They wanted one thing, to destroy Andrew Wakefield, because their golden goose was threatened. The book, Callous Disregard, Autism and Vaccines, The Truth Behind a Tragedy. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Wakefield.
It's a pleasure. I'm delighted to be here.
Dr. Wakefield, you just had a book come out called Callous Disregard, Autism and Vaccines, The Truth Behind a Tragedy. And of course, this was written in response to this study that I briefly mentioned that was published in The Lancet in February 1998. Can you give our audience just a little bit of background on what that study was looking at?
Certainly. I mean, just as a sort of a broad brush, never in the field of human endeavor has so much been said by so many about a scientific or a medical paper that has been read or understood by so few people. It's quite extraordinary. The paper itself was what is called a case series, and that is a very simple description of the clinical story, in this case of a group of children who presented with autistic regression. So they were normal or near normal, and they lost skills and regressed into autism. And at the same time, around the same time, they developed gastrointestinal problems, diarrhea, pain, abdominal pain, bloating, failure to thrive.
Right.
And this is just the clinical description of those children. So it's a reiteration of the parent's story about what happened to their children, the clinical investigation of those children according to their symptoms,
right,
and then the findings. And right, then at the end of it, a sort of speculation about what all of this might mean. Now, the parents came to me in May 1995, the first parent came to me telling the story. She
right,
wasn't anti-vaccine. She'd taken her kid on time to be vaccinated. And following the vaccine, he developed a high fever and problems and had then started to slip away, regressed into autism, and developed terrible intestinal problems. And the medical profession, just ignore that, someone's calling in. The medical profession said, well, your kid's autistic, they're bound to have these bowel problems. Well, that made absolutely no sense whatsoever. So a team of doctors, a multidisciplinary team of some of the best pediatric gastroenterologists in the world, a neurologist, a child psychiatrist, and others got together and decided what clinical tests were needed to properly investigate these children. It was not felt that they had had adequate investigation of their symptoms before. And when the parents had told other doctors that it was the vaccine that it, they believed caused their child's regression into autism, well, that was it. Many of them were thrown out of the practice, were shouted at, were told they were just looking for something to blame, were told it was coincidence. And they were left high and dry. They were left with nothing. They lost complete confidence in the medical profession. So we decided to do our job properly. Nothing more than that. No rocket science, just to do the medicine properly.
Right.
And so we did. And what I did as part of that was to conduct a research analysis of the biopsies taken from these children. That is, the little pieces of tissue taken from the lining of the intestine during the colonoscopy, and examine those in great detail.
Right.
All of that was reported in The Lancet. And it turns out, many years later, and I was just reading a paper online now from London in a national newspaper, The Daily Mail, saying bowel problems are real in autism, and we now have a diagnostic test where we can look at a urine sample and look at bad things coming from across the bowel wall, because it is well known that children with autism have bowel problems. Well, it wasn't well known then, and it's been denied by the authorities for a long time
right.
since, but it is a fact.
So all they had to do was just mention vaccines, and that lifted the hairs on the back of their necks up, it seems.
Well, that's right. And you and I know that if those children had gone in to the doctor's office and the parents had said, my child was fine until they had natural chickenpox, which they caught from another child at a party, and then they regressed, well, there would have been hell to pay. They would have been investigated thoroughly, and there would have been an outcry for mandatory vaccination against chickenpox because children were succumbing in big numbers to this disease. But no, when it's a vaccine, it's unmentionable. It
right.
can't even be discussed.
And they can't even do vaccine safety studies.
Well, you know, when I got into this, I thought, well, if you're going to start challenging public health policy and vaccines, which are, you know, the sort of sacred calf of this, of the medical institution in many ways, I thought to myself, I'm going to have to go and do due diligence. I'm going to have to read all of the papers that have been published on measles, vaccine safety, MMR vaccine safety, what was done, when, by whom, and how thoroughly. And I wrote a 250-page report on this, and I was absolutely appalled. In fact, I wish I'd done that work before I gave my first two children their MMR vaccine.
Right.
So
right.
I made the recommendation that
right.
children might want to opt for the single vaccines rather than the triple, because of the safety studies of the single vaccines were superior to those of the triple.
Right, and the triple, you're referring to the MMR, is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, and the measles, is that referred to as English measles, and rubella is German measles?
It's a good question. I've only ever heard it called measles or rubiola, whereas
okay.
rubella is, as you say, German measles.
Okay, so in other words, you were recommending that instead of combining all three live viruses, that they separate them, because there really were no vaccine safety studies done. They just combined the three, and they changed the vaccine schedule, and you said, wait a second, the paperwork is showing here, or the evidence is showing here, that perhaps we should separate them. And what happened after you suggested that?
Well, first of all, I mean, just as a background to that, it was
Please.
Clear, it was obvious from the time they put these viruses together in the same vaccine, measles, mumps, and rubella, that they were interfering with each other. They were altering the outcome to the component viruses by the host, the immune system of the child who'd been vaccinated. And that's really worrying. You know, it was altering the immune response. Now, what were the implications of that for safety? No one knew, but no one seemed to care. All they cared about was they had to juggle with the amount of the individual vaccines to get the same effect, sometimes in doubling them, sometimes increasing them by a factor of 5 or 10. Well, what are the implications of that for safety? And nobody seemed to worry. It was just an irritation. Well, I worried because I've studied this in great detail,
right.
and I have major concerns that these viruses can hang around for years and do very strange things. And so soon after they started using the vaccine in the UK, then problems were reported.
Right.
And I came in sometime later, and the documentary evidence now shows and is disclosed in the book that the problems with the vaccine were known even before it was licensed in the UK. It had been one of the brands used in the UK, the major brand that got 85% of the market,
right.
had been withdrawn in Canada at the time it was licensed in the UK, and it was withdrawn in Canada because the mumps component was causing meningitis at an unacceptable level. So the Canadians withdrew it. How is it possible that the UK authorities, knowing this, went ahead and licensed it in the UK? Extraordinary situation.
How did they do it? Why would they do it?
Well, you know, this is a question I want to put to them. Did they do it because the vaccine was produced by the home team, a UK company, SmithKline Beecham, as opposed to Merck, whose vaccine did not cause this meningitis problem? And that was known. So why did they do it? And what was alarming, and this came to me through a whistleblower from the government that I met on Newcastle Station in the north of England on a cold Sunday afternoon, where he told me that he had come from Canada as a chief medical officer who had been involved in the MMR program there and the withdrawal of that vaccine, that dangerous vaccine, to advise the UK authorities on the introduction of MMR in the UK. And he said to them, do not introduce this vaccine.
Right. This is Dr. Alistair Thors?
Alistair Thors, that's right, yes. Absolutely. And they ignored him. And so despite his protests, they introduced this vaccine. Immediately that they did, they started encountering problems, cases of meningitis being reported. At the same time, it was licensed in Japan, and cases of meningitis started to be reported from Japan. All of this is documented in the minutes of the committee, the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization.
Right.
And these documents became available to me during the course of the recent legal hearings. And it became clear that there was a problem, and to the point where even members of the JCVI became worried about their own liability rather than being concerned about the effect on children.
Right.
And lo and behold, 4 years after its introduction, it was withdrawn because in the UK it caused meningitis, and at a much higher level than had previously been expected.
I'm at a loss for words. I can't see how these individuals who are responsible for protecting children, really, it seemed like none of that went into their equation. And of course, the study that really created the uproar that you, along with, what was it, 13 or 14 other doctors?
Yeah, there were a total of 13 authors on that paper.
13 authors. And on page 11, you say that the Lancet paper stimulated a series of subsequent papers, rarely if ever acknowledged by critics, that confirmed and characterized the bowel disease as novel, relatively frequent, and potentially treatable, and tested ideas about causation. And that's just what you're talking about. You were just looking on the internet and you saw a paper that related to this. And of course, they don't want to bring up the other papers that...
Oh, the idea that it's been confirmed is something they just don't want to discuss. That's very worrying, because I was in an interview with Matt Lauer on the Today Show recently, and then that was repeated the other day, where he said no one else has been able to replicate the work. Now, I gave his producer the papers.
Right.
The replication of our finding of the bowel disease from Italy, from Venezuela, from the US, from Canada, and five different countries of the world, including the UK, where this bowel disease has been categorically described. So for them, with these papers in their hands, to go out there and say no one has been able to replicate the work,
right,
is frankly wrong, and it's misleading. It is false. And the American public deserve better than that.
Yeah, I unfortunately saw that interview on YouTube, because I personally don't watch television, but I did watch it for this interview. And he's, as far as I'm concerned, he's just a shill for his bosses, because he didn't mention anything other than the reports of MMR vaccine not being responsible for autism. And I was kind of hoping you would come at him a little bit, but you were the gentleman in that exchange.
Well, the point I tried to get across, and I hope came across, is that whatever the American government may be telling the people, there is no link between vaccines and autism. They have, in fact, been settling cases of vaccine-induced autism in vaccine court since 1991.
Right.
So they're telling the American public one thing on the one hand, and actually something else completely different is the truth.
The Hannah Poling case, right?
Hannah Poling, Misty Hyatt case from Florida, the Bailey Banks case most recently, and there are many of these cases, and more are coming to light. So it is not true that there is no link. They acknowledge there is a link. This is not me saying it, it's them saying it. So
right.
So him guy out there, well, the point that I was trying to make to him and reinforce to him, because you get very little opportunity to make other than maybe one or two points on these shows,
right,
is to hammer that home, that the American public need to start thinking critically about vaccines. Do not just be spoon-fed by what you are told, because the agenda out there is not necessarily one which has your child's best interests at heart.
Right, and that's obvious. Is there anybody that's there to speak on behalf of the children? I mean, besides you, is there anyone out there within the network of the medical profession or the public medical authorities? Is there anyone out there that's an advocate for the children?
Well, I think there are many people now who are coming to terms with the fact that there's a problem. You know, they are seeing so many cases. They are seeing so many children with chronic immune diseases, children that were, these diseases were never seen before. So where have they come from? You know, despite the public health policy, children in this country have never been sicker in terms of these chronic immune diseases like asthma, eczema, hay fever, diabetes, Crohn's disease, and autism, neurodevelopmental disorders like autism. So where have they come from? We've dealt with the issue that there is a real epidemic. There is no question about that now. The CDC accepted. So where has it come from? And the tragedy, as I go to more and more of these meetings, is that doctors are coming to the realization there is a problem because their own children have been damaged. And that's very cruel. That's very sad.
Absolutely.
I'm afraid it's a wake-up call that there is a real problem.
Now, in your book, you detail pretty much everything that transpired from the beginning till the current time. There you talk about the Dean Zuckerman, I believe. Was that his name?
That's right. Yes.
Yeah, Dean Zuckerman and his lapses and the fact that it seems like he got away with it. He said one thing. He perhaps lied under oath. He perhaps, to the best of his recollection, he couldn't remember. You talked about that fellow Rutter. And the fact
yes.
that, the very important fact that, and what was Rutter's title at the time?
Rutter, Professor Sir Michael Rutter, Fellow of the Royal Society, is a very eminent expert in autism in the UK and has written extensively about it, redefining it year after year. And the great irony of this, and these things happen rarely in life, but as I was going through a vast body of literature in anticipation of the case against me by a journalist at the General Medical Council, where Professor Rutter had denied in American Vaccine Court and UK Vaccine Court that there was any link between vaccines and autism there.
Right.
In 1994 was a paper where he was the first person to describe the link. And not only did he describe the link between immunization and autism, but he called it the probable cause.
Mm-hmm.
And that's extraordinary, because in our paper in The Lancet, we said we have not even proven an association, let alone a causal association. That's very powerful language. That, you know, he could be blamed for a worldwide run on vaccination, because he doesn't even specify which immunization. So
right.
that basically covers all vaccines. So,
right.
You know, people say one thing and they do another, and that is typical of the hypocrisy that pervades this whole arena.
Absolutely. That was very clear in your book, Callous Disregard. And I guess what's most important about Rutter in this story is that he was the one pointing the finger at you, saying that you had the conflicts of interest, when in fact he was on the payroll of several different entities whose main purpose was to disprove the association between the vaccines and autism-related disorders. Isn't that right?
That's right. I hope the book covers the issue of conflict relatively clearly. It's a changing field. And when I published
right.
the paper in The Lancet back in 1998, I followed the rules of The Lancet. And The Lancet required that you, that is me, the author, decided what was or was not a conflict. It was my decision about what I felt.
It was subjective, right.
That's right. And that none of the children in the Lancet paper had, at the time of their referral to the Royal Free to be seen for their problems, none of them was involved in litigation. So it would have been misleading to talk about a future litigation which didn't involve these children at that time. So I did not disclose it. That does not mean it was a secret. It was not known. It was known throughout the medical school, and it was known, in fact, as it turns out, by The Lancet for a year prior to publication. It was in the national media. There was no secret.
You didn't hide anything. It was the reverse. You exposed everything.
I was very happy for this to be out there. You know, it was national news that there was this potential litigation and that I was part of it. So, but Professor Rutter, the rules changed about disclosure. They changed from it being my decision or the author's decision to being what would other people reading this perceive to be a possible conflict? And that's clearly a much bigger agenda.
Right.
Because you have to put yourself in their shoes and say, well, what would other people consider? And of course, if you take an opposite view, you could interpret anything as being a conflict. So it's a much broader remit. He published five papers after the change in the rules where he made absolutely no disclosure, and those papers directly referred to the fact that vaccines did not cause autism, were not a cause of autism. The evidence didn't support them being a cause of autism. So he made no disclosure in those papers when the rules were much tougher. And ironically, he was on the editorial board of one of those journals that published his paper,
right,
where the rules were quite explicit about disclosure. And presumably being on the editorial board, he approved of those rules. So to stand up at the General Medical Council and say that he would have disclosed in the Lancet paper, when in fact he did not live by that standard, not operate by those rules, then again, it's a measure of the hypocrisy that has pervaded this issue.
Right. And then, of course, on page 170, you say that while you followed the disclosure rules in 1997 when the paper was submitted to The Lancet, the GMC, which is the General Medical Council, is that right?
That's correct. Yes.
The GMC, I was judged according to the current rules. So what they did was they allowed you to use the rules that were in place when you produced the paper that went in The Lancet. But then they judged you based on the current rules. Is that, I don't understand. How could they get away with that?
Well, you know, my lawyers pointed this out to them, made it very, very clear. And so it should have been unambiguous to the panel who made the decision on guilt or innocence, that there was, I was innocent. I had followed the rules, but they didn't. Now, that fact, plus all of the other rulings, really leads me to believe that they had made up their minds from the beginning, that they were under political pressure to come to a specific decision in order to silence dissent and silence questions over the safety of MMR vaccine. And that, I'm afraid, is what I believe to be the fact.
Right, right. Now, of course, much of this might not have happened if it wasn't for this reporter by the name of Brian Deer from the London Sunday Times. Tell our listeners a little bit about this fellow. What motivated him to come after you, guns a-blazing?
Where he came from, I don't know. In other words, what motivated him and where his funding came from, if any, I simply don't know. And it would be speculation on my part. But he has, he was on the Sunday Times as a staff member. He then left that job for some reason. And he disappeared off for some year and then returned, appearing to take the side of the pharmaceutical industry, particularly SmithKline-Beecham in the UK. And was that a factor that motivated this story? It may well have been, but I do not know, and therefore probably better not to speculate at this stage. That is not to say that it's not under active investigation. But he is an odd character, to say the least. One only needs to read his website to see that there is clear personality problem with this man. He seems obsessional and makes these issues very, very personal. I don't see this as a personal issue. This is a matter of science and medicine. This is not a personal issue, but he seems to wish to make it a personal issue. And that's his problem. Now, I once had a professor of psychiatry who put this in context, and he got into an elevator one day with a patient who was a chronic schizophrenic, and the schizophrenic saw him and kicked him as hard as he could in the shin, and my professor was about to remonstrate with him, and he then thought to himself, no, this is your problem, and I'm afraid this is Brian Deere's problem.
Right. Now, what about this Professor Tom McDonald? This guy reportedly vowed to destroy your career. Is that...
Yes, McDonald is again, an interesting character, on the face of it, an eminent scientist in the UK, but when Professor John Walker Smith moved from one hospital to another in the UK because his hospital of origin was under threat of closure, came to work at the Royal Free in the same hospital as me, I think McDonald felt that I had in some way poached him for the purpose of getting access to children rather than just trying to preserve what was one of the world's leading units under threat of closure. McDonald was offered to come to the Royal Free, and he refused and vowed at that point to destroy my career. And again, very personal, and I don't understand it because I didn't feel any personal animosity towards him, but he certainly has been a substantial help to Deere in prosecuting his case against me.
Right. Now, Deere's the article that Deere came out with, which is filled with glaring inconsistencies, and seems like from your chapter on Deere, downright lies. The Press Complaints Commission of the UK, a complaint was filed, and they required that the articles, all of his articles pertaining to this matter, be removed from the Sunday Times website. But they put them back up. Is that right?
Yes, a press release was issued pointing out that they had been instructed to do this, and they clearly took exception to that and defied the ruling of the Press Complaints Commission and put the articles back up. So it speaks really to the authority, the power of the Press Complaints Commission, that they're not even able to enforce their own ruling, and that does not give me cause for optimism in pursuing this case. This is a situation that we don't have it here in the U.S. is a self-regulating body which oversees the conduct of the press, sort of ethical conduct.
Right.
And it seems to be toothless in the U.K. because it was unable to get them to follow the rules, and I therefore don't hold out much hope for them making any findings against one of their own.
Yeah, you're up against the big boys, Dr. Wakefield, and it doesn't seem like there's too many people in your corner, except for, of course, the parents, who really you are somewhat of a cause célèbre, a hero to a lot of parents all around the world, and they know that. And what are they afraid of? Are they afraid that vaccination rates are gonna drop off? I mean, they talk about how, because the Lancet paper created a scare amongst parents, and they seized vaccinations, they bring up the point that two children, unfortunately, two children is too many, but two children had died from not having the vaccine because of the paper's results. How many children have been harmed or killed by having the vaccine?
It's a very good question, and one that is going to be impossible to answer, I'm afraid, because vaccines are not given in isolation, and the vaccine schedule changes repeatedly, and therefore to try and pin this down is going to be very difficult. Just to give you an example, MMR vaccine is not even one thing. If you give vaccine, what happened in the US is that the dose of the mumps virus in the vaccine has changed substantially over time. In other words, it's a different drug. It's a different biological. It's not the same as MMR was when it started. So, but the claim in the UK that I was responsible for a scare which led to a fall in vaccine uptake is wrong. In fact, I urge parents to get the single vaccines as an alternative to the MMR. And at that time in the UK, the single vaccines were available.
Right.
So demand was very high because parents were genuinely concerned, not because I'd started a scare,
right,
but because my colleagues and I had responded to a scare. The parents bought us this story, right, and we reacted to it professionally and compassionately. Now, what happened in, I made that suggestion in February 1998. And in the fall of 1998, the British government withdrew the importation license for the single vaccines. They made it impossible for parents to get the single vaccines on the NHS. So at a time when the demand was at its highest,
right,
they took, for the single vaccines, they took that choice away. Now, if your priority is to protect children, why would you do that? Why would you take away an option for how they might protect, be protected against an infectious disease that you're concerned about?
Right.
And I asked a member of the public health authority in the UK, why did you do this? And she said, because if we allowed parents the choice of single vaccines, it would destroy our MMR program. So their decision was taken in order to protect the program and not children, and that is reprehensible.
Right, absolutely. And of course, you're not against vaccines, right?
Not at all. I am all for safe vaccines, but it has to be a safety-first vaccine agenda. Safety first. Who could possibly argue with that? You're going to give something to millions, in fact, all of the world's children. That is the intention. Healthy children. Why would you not put safety first as the priority? And that has not happened.
In the Lancet paper, you clearly said we haven't proven any association. All you did was suggest that more research be done on it. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay.
And I'm afraid the axe fell for that reason. They had to stop the work. They had to set an example to other doctors. You asked why other doctors didn't get involved. I think for many of them, they know there's a problem and they are just terrified. And it is intended, my example is intended, as Voltaire said, the French playwright, to encourage the others. And
right.
And that is what it is being used for.
The pioneers are the ones with the arrows in their backs, right?
Well, you know, I don't tend to see myself. I just see myself as a doctor doing a job. You know, I'm trying to do a job because that is what the parents thought to me. That is what they said. And I cannot walk away from that. It's not particularly heroic or clever. It's just doing a job, and I'm not going to be put off doing it because it offends someone's policy or affects someone's profit margin.
I know you're a brave man. Most people would not do it, what you did and are doing. Now, of course, this is a huge, huge industry. The book, The History of the Peanut Allergy Epidemic, which I mentioned to you earlier, prior to the interview, it states that by 2008, the vaccine industry was a $500 billion market. So this is big. This is a big industry that you're going against, isn't it?
It is. It's huge. And what's particularly concerning about the industry itself is that it's on its knees. The big pharma, in terms of its traditional revenue stream through innovation of new drugs, a pipeline of pharmaceutical agents coming out, that's dried up. There's nothing left. There are no new patents, and the Human Genome Project has completely failed to materialize in terms of producing new targets for drugs, and so they've got their backs to the wall, except for vaccines. So vaccines are the growth area. Vaccines are the things that will save them, and vaccines are something that the government, once those vaccines are licensed and made mandatory, we'll protect them against. They have no liability. So it's a win-win situation. Sign them, get them out there, and you have no liability. How could it be? Would a car manufacturer be allowed to put a car on the road with no liability? No, they would not.
No,
they would not. So why is it that with our most precious possessions, our children, where you expose them to these agents that have been inadequately tested in an environment where there is no liability on the behalf of the manufacturer?
It seems that the government entities that are supposedly supposed to protect children are instead protecting the pharmaceuticals. And that same book, The History of the Peanut Allergy Epidemic, Heather Fraser points out that according to the CDC, which is, of course, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, they said that combination vaccines reduced the number of injections, improved vaccination timeliness and coverage, and reduced shipping and storage costs. It seems like all those reasons are just economic for the industry, and there's nothing mentioned about children.
Yeah, I mean, that is a measure. That is a clear indication of where they place their priorities, economic priorities, and that is absolutely unacceptable.
Then on January 28th of this year, the General Medical Council, their findings, what happened with that?
Well, the principal finding against us was that we had conducted what they said was unethical research on children, in other words, experimentation without permission. Now, they got it completely wrong, and so we were astonished that they came to this position, because the children, as my clinical colleagues who decided on those clinical investigations pointed out, those investigations were undertaken explicitly for the symptoms the children suffered. It's just like a child coming in with a cold or a sore throat, the doctor examining them and saying, this is what you've got, you need to go on this antibiotic. It was no more than that. That does not require an ethical approval, and yet they claim that this clinical investigation of the developmental regression and the gastrointestinal problems in these children was an experiment, not clinical. It was not. It was absolutely not. And so they got it wrong. They got it completely wrong. And right. That was the main plank of the findings against us. And they then claim that I had no ethical approval for the conduct of the research. And they relied upon a later approval, saying that these children came in and were investigated before that approval was given. So therefore, you were unethical. No, there was an existing ethical approval presented, approved 1 year before, that covered the research that I did. The consent form that is required with these approvals was present in the records of every single child presented in evidence at that General Medical Council hearing. A consent form there, signed by the doctor, signed by the parent, and there was an absence of the later consent form for the later study. So you've got two pieces of evidence, a positive piece of evidence showing that there is a consent form for the existing study, and an absence of a consent form for the later study, and they come to the conclusion that it was done under the later study. How can that be? So it defies logic, and again reinforces to me the notion that they'd made up their minds before we even went into the room.
That's obvious. They ignored all the evidence, and they did make up their minds. And of course, that date is significant. In the afterword of your book, January 28th, 2010 may go down as the day that innovative clinical care died in the United Kingdom. And how important is their decision to innovative clinical care?
Well, I think it's so important, because now all clinicians presented with complex problems, presented with the unknown, which we are so often in medicine, are going to be extremely reluctant to investigate people appropriately for fear that they're going to be hauled up in front of the General Medical Council. You know, possible drug reactions where the patient comes in, doesn't matter how sick they are, the doctor is going to be scared of doing the appropriate investigations, potentially life-saving investigations, because someone funded by a pharmaceutical industry is going to come after them and have them hauled up in front of a regulatory body and struck off for doing their job. And that means, I'm afraid, that we have capitulated to the pharmaceutical industry. Medicine and science have no merit, no value anymore if we're going to allow that to happen. And I, for one, refuse to let that happen. I did not go into this job, this vocation, to whore myself to the pharmaceutical companies.
You're a brave man, Dr. Wakefield, and you are a hero to many parents. And I hope that your work can carry forward and folks will go out and pick up this book, Callous Disregard, Autism and Vaccines, A Truth Behind a Tragedy. Now, do you have a website, Dr. Wakefield?
Yes, we do. Thank you very much. Yeah, the website where people can get the book is callous-disregard.com. And go on there, buy the book, and a portion of the proceeds, if we ever make a profit, will go towards autism research, much needed autism research, and there'll be news and opinions and events on that website as well that may be helpful to people.
Okay, so that's callous-disregard.com, callousdisregard.com, and you can get your copy of Dr. Wakefield's fine book from that website. Dr. Wakefield, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to speak with us. And I know I probably speak for a lot of people. I told you earlier that I'm a dad of an autistic child. I have an almost 16-year-old son who has autism. And I wish you the best of luck. I'm sure, like I said, there's probably millions of parents who feel the same way I do. Thanks so much, Dr. Wakefield.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.